it didn't keep her up at night reading it. I don't know what she thinks about anything that I do. She never hears my songs, which are mostly all about her, until they're recorded. You know, I never sit down with her and say, "Oh, sweetheart, here's a little song I wrote for you."
Yeah.
It's just this sort of weird dead spot where I do what I do. And, you know, when I was writing the memoir, she was a little bit more active in the process where I'd read her something because I thought it was wildly funny, and she'd say, "Oh, God, honey, you can't put that in the book." And I was like, "Yeah, I can." I ran it by my lawyer.
Well, yeah, I imagine, I know that you both love horses, and that she was, she was the one that recontacted with me. I'll give people a little background. I used to work in a music store in Cambridge, Mass, called Cambridge Music Center, which is now defunct.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And I was listening to all kinds of radio stations, but a lot of the folk, UMB and obviously WMFO. And they were playing your brother Stan and some of his music and yours. And then one day you strolled in and you were talking. We were talking about old Stratocasters and music. And we were swapping war stories about playing gigs. And that's how I came familiar with you. And I went to your gigs. And I really enjoy your music.
Thanks.
You got something special going on there. And I like that we made a connection there when we were making some nice stories with each other, and it's always interesting. You could probably tell some ones you can tell. You know, when you're on the road and you meet people and things happen that are not happening in sometimes regular people's lives, is there any stories that you can relay? I know some you can't.
Oh, boy.
I might get you in trouble here.
I can't repeat the punchline on the radio, but I had a woman. I've been thinking about her a lot because Bill Staines was sort of on the tag end of the story, and we just lost Bill. But there was a woman who used to follow me around all throughout the Midwest, anywhere between Dayton, Ohio, and all the way up to Winnipeg, Manitoba. And she was a strange little thing. She very thin, hair pulled back, blondish. And she sort of she reminded me of the woman in American Gothic, you know, that painting. And she was very severe looking, with her hair pulled back and glasses and a little, pinafore dress. And but she used to turn up at my shows, and she never spoke to me. She was just this really obsessive person. She would come in the venue, like, "Oh God, there she is again," and she was just totally focused on me, and she never spoke to me directly. She had, I'm not making this up, she had a hand puppet that was dressed exactly like her. It was her hand puppet. And they always wore matching outfits. Whatever she was wearing, the hand puppet wore.
Yeah.
And I'd be sitting, tuning my guitar, or maybe I'd be having a drink or something, and or trying to finish my dinner, and she would just start edging up towards me across the room. She'd be walking sideways, not looking at me, but the puppet would be, and the puppet had these big dark puppet eyes, and it was really incredibly creepy. And of course, she was just vibrating because she was so nervous, and she'd get closer and closer, and she'd finally have this puppet thrust into my face about 8 inches away from me, but not looking at me.
Yeah.
And I knew her name. I said, "Diane, please, I don't want to talk to the puppet. It's humiliating. I'm happy to talk to you, but, I don't want to talk to this puppet. It's just weird." And the puppet would get a little bit closer, and in this tiny, tiny, tiny little puppet voice, the puppet would say, "She wants you to F her." Except she'd use the word. And so that kept on for about 5 years. And finally, the last time I saw her was in St. Paul, Minnesota, and I was doing a co-bill with Bill Staines. And I said, "Bill, I got to warn you. I got this whack job following me around, and, she may turn up tonight, and I just, you may want to just keep your distance when she does arrive. Well, yes, she did, in fact, arrive. And Bill and I are at our merchandise table, and we're just talking to people after the show. And she arrives. She does not have the puppet with her. She's got this long box. So you could either hold a rifle or a dozen long-stem roses. But it's, you know, this box. And she's coming towards me, and she's sort of looking at me, but not. I said, hi, Diane. How are you? And she held the box out, and she said, here. I said, what's that? And she says, I made it for you. Take it. And I said, no. And she said, just open the box. And I said, no, I really don't feel comfortable. So she put it on the floor, and she opened it. And within 2 seconds, Bill was gone, and about 30 people who were around the merch table were gone. I was completely alone with this woman. And it was a puppet of me. And it looked just like me, except it had the dark, you know, the big dark puppet eyes. And I said, what am I supposed to do with this?
Yeah.
And it's, you know, like I said, this is the first time she'd ever spoken to me directly. Yeah. And she looked right at me and she said, now we can talk.
Wow, that's pretty heavy.
Well, I didn't dare leave it behind. Yeah. I didn't want to put it in the dumpster because it had so much voodoo attached to it. I thought, you know, someone's going to throw it into a fire and I'll burst into flames on I-94 somewhere. So I took it home. My wife wouldn't let it in the house. My dog wouldn't go near it. I ended up wrapping it in about 800 yards of duct tape, and I took it to the landfill.
Wow.
So that's just one.
Yeah, I'm surprised you didn't donate it to, some political party.
I didn't want it in the hands of anybody.
Yeah.
It gives me the creeps even thinking about it.
We had a call on one of the shows, and because I was nice to her, she became kind of, I don't know, focused on me, not the DJ. And one day, one of the persons in the crew goes, Mike, there's somebody down at the front door looking for you. And I said to myself, I have to deal with this. And I didn't know what to expect, you know. And I was, you know, I'm ready with my cell phone. And I go down there, and there's a woman in a walker.
Uh-huh.
And that was the woman. And we invited her up. She made it up the stairs because we're on the third floor. She sat and she didn't say anything. We asked her some questions on air. She didn't say too much. She read a magazine, and about an hour later, the MBTA ride came and picked her up, and she went away. It was very, very, very odd.
Yeah,
we all have those stories. So
yeah, I mean, there's a lot of lonely people out there, and some of them focus, you know, a little too hard on what you're doing, you know, and you have to learn how to defuse it without taking away their pride or their dignity or whatever. It's a fine line.
After you, I'm going to be interviewing later on Joe Milken on the book on Ben Orr from the Cars. And there's a point where they had made synchro sound in Boston. It used to be an intermediate sound. And this guy starts showing up, and he's like throwing bottles and putting threats. He was all directed at Rick Ocasek. And Ben Orr, having grown up in, you know, Cleveland and been a sportsman and shot guns, went out and talked to the guy. And whatever he said to the guy didn't come back for several months. So he was brave enough to hit it head on, but there are people out there. And, you know, when you're in the public, whether it be radio or performer or whatever, you always got to be looking over your shoulder. You never know what could happen, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I just try to be available to people and try to diffuse whatever. I mean, people think, oh, because he's on stage, he must be special. Well, you know, if they talk to you for a while, they find out pretty damn quick that you're not. You know, so I just try to diffuse it that way. And I'd much rather I'd much rather just talk to somebody than sign an autograph or whatever. It's just, you know, I try to remove that barrier, but some people. You know, there's a lot of just broken, you know, people out there.
What is your favorite part of the business, and what's your not favorite part of the business? Books and being a performer.
The travel got way, way more irksome. About 15 years ago, I was having problems with it, and my parents were getting ill, and I was having to, my wife and I were kind of the sole caretakers of my parents, and they both had serious problems. So there was that. And after my parents died 10 years ago, I just realized, man, it's really finite. You know, our life is really finite, and the travel is just getting more and more difficult. And So I started doing farewell tours, you know, places like the West Coast. I did one last tour of the West Coast, and that's it forever. I'm not going to do it anymore. And my radius had shrunk quite a bit. You know, so the driving, the hotels, the food, all the nonsense that you go through and being in cities. I mean, Gail and I live on a gravel road, for God's sake. You know, we have a farm, you know, we're just, it's quiet out here. And you suddenly find yourself, you know, on the George Washington Bridge at 5 in the afternoon trying to figure out what the heck you're doing.
Yeah.
It seems awfully complex. And so that, I was actually just talking to my best friend a couple hours ago. We were just talking about, anxiety, dealing with anxiety. He's having a tough time. And I've always had problems with it. And you know, it led to me, you know, drinking too much. And, you know, I was a terrible alcoholic for years. But, you know, he said, you know, he was asking me, how do you deal with being on stage with the kind of anxiety you go through? And I said, well, actually, that's my comfort zone now. Like, I get on stage, it's like I've got the guitars there. I know what I'm just, it might be the only place in my life where I actually know what I'm doing. I know how to play guitar. I know how to sing. I know how to communicate with people and tell a few jokes and listen to them. And it's what I look forward to now. Like, everything else kind of drives me nuts. But, man, it's like 8 o'clock, you know, the lights go up and it's like, oh, okay, here I am. This is better. You know, this is why I drove 7 hours. This is why I'm staying in a hotel. This is, you know, why I'm dealing with a bad meal.
Yeah.
I used to have terrible, terrible stage fright and anxiety, particularly, you know, when I was starting out again after my brother was killed.
Yeah.
But, you know, living with people's expectations, but, you know, on stage now, it's just kind of like, well, hooray, you know, this is good. And I kind of come off stage and feel like, well, that's that done. And it's, you know, and I visit with people afterwards, and it's really quite lovely.
Well, we definitely love you in the Boston area. I love seeing you perform. If you ever change your mind and come back, I'll buy the dinner.
Well, thanks.
You know, like Kelly's, right?
I will be coming back. I'm just dipping my toe very gradually into playing again. I'm playing in New Bedford at the festival this year.
Okay.
Provided my visa comes through. But, you know, some of the New England clubs that just, you know, they're, you know, second homes for me. Places like, you know, me and Dee and Passing and, you know,
Passing.
All these places.
Yeah.
And I have such a long history with these rooms and such good people and such a sense of community. I really remember, you know, early on in the 80s, you know, like listening to Dick Pleasance, you know, when I first became aware of him and just, I'd be just driving around listening to him all day or, you know, just, you know, I'd be sitting in front of my hotel room, you know, waiting for a song to end to, you know, well, who the heck was that? And you really did have this sense of extraordinary community in that part of the world. And I don't find it a lot of other places in North America, parts of California. But New England is really unique. I feel so connected to it and so lucky to have been, you know, been part of it.
When I was young, you know, between, I don't know, junior high school, I became very aware of what was going on the radio. And Boston was kind of a jazz folk town, you know, before the rock thing really took off and like that. And some of my relatives and tenants we had in the house as a young kid, like, you were playing jazz and folk and all kinds of stuff. And my friends, also musicians, kind of turned me on to love stuff. So I feel really privileged to be in a very rich area. You know, 11 years ago, I got involved in radio, and I have my good host over here, Mike Newman. And my friend Bobby is doing tech for us. And it's been a very enriching thing. Sometimes, you know, hard. But I get to meet people like you. Really, people that really put out a really good product, as they say in the business. And are generally nice. Unfortunately, you know, there's always people. You kind of remember the people that don't treat you well, but you really appreciate the people that treat you decently and that are nice to you and stuff like that. So that's why when I had the opportunity to do this interview, I was really more than happy to do this. Not just the book, but just to touch base and see how you're doing and if maybe there's another book in you, another tour, what's going on in your life. Anything you'd like to share with us?
Well, the thing I mentioned, I'm sort of toying with a sequel to the, you know, the Six Crows Gold book. And it starts out kind of, again, it starts out ugly, and I don't know where it's going to go.
Yeah.
And what the thing that's holding me back is I'm going to have to do a lot more of this research. I love the writing part of it. I love writing dialogue. I love writing relationships and all that, but the research is irksome. I've got a couple of other things I need to get out of my life before I can settle down into sitting out in the backyard every day and tapping away. I'm still working on new songs. You know, I'm still going to go out and do some shows because I really do enjoy them.
Well, when you come back through this area, you're definitely invited to my house and we can bang on some of my old guitars and you know what I have. And we could sit down with some of our DJ musician friends and we'll have a dinner or lunch or something like that.
That sounds terrible.
Yeah, we do have this thing called seafood here. I don't know what they're thinking, you know. Being from Canada, you know, some of my folks are from Canada. They're from Nova Scotia, Newfoundland. You must probably talk to people. They say, well, you go through the United States. What are they thinking is happening here? I know I've been dealing with some people. This Irish woman just said recently, who's been staying here for a while, she goes, me and my husband are getting out of here. We're going to Denmark, you know? I mean, I consider, you know, Massachusetts somewhat safe and stuff like that. Is there an overall feeling that things are way out of control here?
Many, many years ago, the father of our current Prime Minister, Prime Minister Pierre Elliott Trudeau, this is back in the late 60s, he said living next door to America was like being an ant in bed with an elephant, and you just pray that the elephant doesn't roll over and sleep. The description we tend to use up here now is it's like living above the meth lab that's on fire. It's like, you know, we're watching the hearings right now, and it's just, you can't really turn away from it because you feel like you're watching history, but man, it's
tough.
It is some scary stuff.
It is.
And you know, I have to sort of limit my exposure to it because there is nothing I can do. I can't make any difference in what's happening.
Yeah.
And to be so intimately acquainted with it is to drive yourself crazy that way. So, but it is very difficult to watch what's going on in your country right now. I mean, we have our own problems in Canada that no one really knows about them outside of our borders. But this has been very difficult. And I don't know what the end result is going to be.
Well, for a last question, we're going to have to wrap up because our next guest will be coming soon. I always ask the guest, besides giving all the websites and Facebooks and all that and current information tours, what is a question you always want to be asked and you never asked? But we already hit on that. Is there anything that you'd just like to say? Anything you'd like to get off your chest?
Nothing to get off my chest. I just, I've kind of reached a point. This is a dangerous thing to say, but I've kind of reached a point in my life where I'm content and happy, and I'm really, really, really successfully concentrating on all the good things that are going on in my life. And I get up every morning And, you know, just seeing nature here, you know, and seeing the trees open up and the flowers bloom and the horses are, you know, you go in the barn and they're all standing up and they're healthy. And you try to be grateful for every little minute. And I'm really, really working on that part of you know, a living plan where, you know, try not to look at the bad part, try not to focus on it and just say, you know, well, look at this over here. This is something I need to think about and celebrate. And part of that is, you know, just the job that I still feel I have, which I'd like to get back to at some point on a somewhat reduced level. But, you know, I've had an extraordinary run, and a run that I never really expected. You know, after Stan died, I just was not expecting to be doing this. But here I am, and it's been pretty good.
Well, I want to thank you and your wife, Gail, hooking back up and talking to you. I really enjoy talking to you. And
likewise, yeah.
Like I said, I'd love to hang out when you come back, and I'll pick your brain because eventually I'm going to have to do my solo record, and I'm going to pick all my friends' brains. Anyways, just give us a little update on your websites and stuff like that.
Sure. It's garnetrogers.com. That pretty much gets you to everything. You can download music and buy CDs if people still do that thing. You can buy the two books. And I've got chapters put up so you can actually read what, you can get an idea what the writing is like and the general atmosphere. And, you know, what little schedule I have anymore, you can keep track of my schedule.
Well, I thank you very, very much. It was great talking to you. I wish you all the best up in Canada. You sound like you guys are in a really good place. I live on a main street where there's a bus stop, so I live in the opposite.
There you go.
Anyways, thank you. That the book is Six Crows Gold. It's a book by Garnet Rogers. He also has another book out about himself. And he has many records out, like Night Drive and a bunch of great CDs. I suggest people go to his site and get them. Thank you again, Garnet, and we will hopefully talk to you soon. Take care.
I love that. Thanks very much, Mike. Take care of yourself. Be safe out there.
Okay, you too. Bye-bye.
Yeah, bye-bye.
I'm listening to the radio.
Tufts Freeform Radio, WMFO, Medford.
Bravo!
Business buying a mare like that, but buy her if you must. He bit the end off his cigar and spat it in the dust. She's old, she's lame and barren too, she's not worth feed and hay. But I'll give her this, he blew smoke at me, she was something in her day. I recall her well 10 years ago. She was a winner in her prime. She was fast and lean and willing, but they raced her past her time. And though she had the heart, her legs were gone, and it wasn't hard to see. They kept her at it in the hopes of just one more small victory. So she was shunted round from track to track, from Kentucky up to Maine. They'd run her in cheap flamers, all doped up to mask her pain. And if it's my advice you want, I'd say the poor thing's had her day. You'd be throwing good cash after bad, it's best you turned away. Well, they led her around the auction shed, and the bidding started low. She'll go for dog food, someone said, and market's been that slow. But she raised her head and pricked her ears, and before the hammer fell, she was mine. My friend turned round to me. You're soft-headed, I can tell. But she's been shoved from pillar to post, said I, and always done her best. They used her up, they wrung her dry, you'd think she'd earned a rest. So if she does not but end her days beneath some shady tree, I'll have saved her from the knacker's yard, and that's enough for me. Near 2 years ago, she's filled out some since then. The more so since she's been in full, she eats enough for ten. And this morn as I crept to the barn around about 3:30, there stood nursing on still trembling legs one more small victory. How bright the stars, how dark the night. How long have I been sleeping? Sleep overtook me on my westward flight. Held me in its keeping. I had a dream, it seemed so real. Passing left me shaking. I saw you here behind the wheel.
Yeah, you're listening to WMFO 91.5 FM, WMFO.org. This is Radio Bookmark. This is Mike Stewart and Mike Newman. Our next guest wrote a book about a really important band in the Boston scene, about a person in that band from Cleveland named Benjamin Orr. And the person wrote is Joe Milken. We wanted to say hello to Joe Milken. How you doing?
Hey, how are you, Mike?
Good, good. you'll have to forgive me. My allergies are hitting me behind my mask right now.
I'm sorry to hear that.
Yeah, well, I know that you've been going through some health stuff, too, so we're thinking about you, and I believe your wife had some issues, too.
Yeah, we've had a long road. She had some complications due to COVID. She already had some pre-existing stuff, health stuff going on. So, yeah, we had a rough road there for a little while, but thankfully she's doing much better now and almost back to 100%. So well, thanks for asking.
We're really glad to hear that. So I'm going to tell people I cheated a little bit. I listened to Steve Ricardo's interview with you. I made it through almost all the book. I'm up to big people. I'm having a problem with my eyes. I read about 3 or 4 pages and my eyes just go crazy. So I've been struggling, but I've been interested because I was there when a lot of this stuff was happening. To kind of set this up, excuse me. When in the early 70s, a friend of mine, they got an apartment in Somerville. And we walked in the bedroom and on the wall was a big mural and said Milkwood. And I said, I've heard that name someplace, you know, because from junior high on, I've been listening, you know, to college radio and FM radio and stuff like that. I said, okay.
Right.
So I was interested in that. And then my friends there were going to the school of contemporary music. He kept bugging me. He goes, you know, I'm hearing about this band called Captain Swing. You got to go see them. They're really, really good.
Uh-huh.
And I said, okay. And by the time I made my mind up, all of a sudden, they're not Captain Swing anymore. They're the Cars. And, you know, I'm going to the Rat and the Channel and the Club and the Underground and Cantones and all the clubs. And I see this band, and obviously they're getting played on college radio. And Max Sand is breaking them on WBCN with their demos and stuff. So they just kind of like fill in. I was going to Mass Art at the time. And a couple people worked there in the band La Peste, which Rick Ocasek and Greg Hawks got involved and helped produce some of their music.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of an interesting story when I'm reading this about Ben Orr. When he comes to Boston, them become so entwined with people that went on to do great things, whether it's Andy Pratt or Brad Delp or Charlie Farron. The list goes on and on and on and on. But
right.
I guess it really says about his talent. What made you decide to do this book?
Well, to be honest with you, so this goes back several years because I worked on the book in my spare time, believe it or not, over about a decade's time working on this book. So it was a really long process. So at the beginning of the process, so this is the first book that I ever wrote, and I had been published already, you know, newspapers and magazines and stuff, but this was my first attempt at a book. So I had a short list of some ideas that I was thinking about, but I hadn't come up with a final decision yet. And so this is going back to, if you remember the original social media, MySpace.
Yeah.
I had a MySpace account, said that I was a writer and, you know, into music journalism and, you know, said that I was from Boston, listed a bunch of my favorite bands. I listed the Cars as one of my influences. And I got a message out of the blue one day from a Cars fan and just out of the blue said, you should write about Ben Orr, not the band, specifically Ben. And I'm like, my initial thought was, well, that's kind of strange. You know, why wouldn't I just write about the band's history? Or if I was going to pick an individual, you know, why not it be Rick, being the front man and the main songwriter or the songwriter? So, you know, Rick would seem more logical. And all she said was, just investigate a little bit. She gave me a couple of names of some people back in Cleveland where Ben's from that knew him in his early days, pre-Cars. So I investigated him a little bit, and you know what really hooked me to write about Ben, or write Ben's life story, was not even really anything that had to do with the Cars. It was the fact that he was a sort of childhood star, if you will, when he was young in Cleveland. You know, he was in a band, one of the hottest bands in the city, called the Grasshoppers.
Yep.
This is in the early 50s. He was 17 years old. His band was the house band on a local TV show in Cleveland called Upbeat, which is kind of like, you know, their version of the American Bandstand show. And so that's what really intrigued me. Here's a 17-year-old kid, you know, 15 years before he, you know, is in the Cars, and he was sort of a star in Cleveland. Obviously, Cleveland's the home of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. So it all just seemed really interesting to me, and I investigated him a little bit more, and I decided that, you know, I got to tell this guy's story. He's only like the second or third native Clevelander to be elected into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. So it's kind of ironic, even though, sadly enough, he passed away before the band got inducted. You know, it was like in his hometown. So talk about someone coming full circle.
Yeah.
So that's kind of what triggered me to pick Ben as an individual. And, of course, you know, all kinds of Cars history and Cars facts throughout the book, too. Obviously, because that's why Ben was famous. So there's a lot of Cars information in there too, but I do, you know, try to emphasize that it is a biography about Ben's life.
Yeah, definitely.
So that's kind of how it happened.
when you're writing, I noticed that a lot of people contributed, and a lot of people from where he grew up and the bands he was in, some of his you know, his partners in life. But you know, three principals, Ocasek, Elliot, and Roy, did not contribute. Were you surprised, or were you saying, well, there's going to be some people that are not going to do that?
I wasn't surprised. Now, what really would have surprised me is if no surviving members of the band would talk to me.
Yeah.
Then I would have been probably challenging in my own mind the legitimacy of the book. How could I write a book about Ben and none of his bandmates contribute any of their thoughts? Thank God that didn't happen. Mr. Hawks and Mr. Robinson were both very kind to me. I got to interview them both a few times and ask them a whole bunch of questions, and it was really great. So I'm very appreciative that those two gentlemen, you know, took the time to participate. I wasn't surprised about Rick. I mean, you know, Ben was known as a very private guy. Well, Rick probably took it to the next level.
Yeah.
He was a very unique individual, if you will, and very private. And, you know, I didn't actually get to... I actually approached him about the book through a mutual friend, someone else that I interviewed for the book. You know, who lived in Boston, was really close to Rick, actually approached him on my behalf, and came back and said, you know, Rick says that, you know, he's glad someone's doing this for Ben. He deserves it. You know, when he felt good about it, he just didn't want to participate. And my friend, our mutual friend, said, Joe, you can't take it personal. I mean, when Ben passed away, I mean, he was turning down interviews from, you know, Rolling Stone magazine and, you know, the New York Times.
Yeah.
Never mind some hole-in-the-wall writer from Vermont who he's never heard of.
Yeah.
So it really didn't surprise me that Rick didn't participate. Elliot, on the other hand, without getting into a lot of detail, I was a little surprised that he declined. But that being said, you know, I'm happy that almost every significant person I contacted otherwise participated. There were only a few people who didn't, so that made me feel good in the end, for sure.
Yeah.
As a matter of fact, I interviewed 120 plus people who knew Ben throughout his life. So,
yeah.
The way I approached the book is, you know, I never got to meet Ben. When I decided to write this book, he had already been passed by, you know, 7 years. He had already been gone. So, you know, I took the approach, if you can't interview the man himself, what's the next best thing? Is to interview as many people who knew him as possible. And I'm talking all the way back to talking to a couple of people in grade school and middle school with him, you know, all the way to the very end when he was with big people at the end of his life.
Yeah.
So I interviewed a lot of people who were really close to him, and that's how I created insights about him. I like to describe it as I kind of drove the bus, and I let the people who knew Ben really tell the story and what they knew and loved about him. And I just kind of kept it on the straight and narrow on the road, if you will, and just drove the bus and let these people tell the story.
It seems that you filled in every spot from when he was a young toddler all the way up to his passing. Was there any parts that you were surprised to learn about him, or any parts that were missing that you couldn't obtain information about him?
Well, I think what surprised me about learning about Ben, probably the fact that he really was, and it almost sounds cliche when you say this, but I don't mean it to be cliche at all. It's the absolute truth. Mm-hmm. Ben was a very down-to-earth kind of guy. He was simple, as in he didn't seek the spotlight. And you know, it's almost hard to say this, because when you see pictures of Ben on stage, especially in the early days, wearing all leather and just decked out to the nines, you know, handsome guy looking like the rock star. And he sort of flipped the switch. He'd turn a switch on and go on stage and be a rock star. And when he came off stage, he'd flip the switch back off and he became a normal guy. When the Cars broke up in the late 80s, he decided to get out of the music business for a few years, which he did. And he sold his house in Boston. He moved to Vermont, which is ironic because I live in Vermont. Mm-hmm. And he wanted to live a simple life. He liked being in the woods. He was a hunter and a fisherman. Those are other things that I didn't know, that he was a woodsman.
Yeah,
you know, you see this rock and roll guy on stage from Cleveland, and that's the last thing you think is him, you know, driving around in a pickup truck. But he did.
Yeah.
He drove a Ford Bronco for many years. So that kind of surprised me about Ben. Maybe not so much that he was a quiet guy, but just that he was very much to himself. He had a really small circle of really close friends. He really needed to get to know somebody before he'd open up to them, kind of a thing.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that was all part of, you know, I mentioned at the beginning about how this book took a decade.
Yeah.
To do, of course, you know, in my spare time, of course, a full-time job and family, and I kind of did my writing on the side. But part of the reason for it taking so long was the interview process, because, you know, I was calling these people out of the blue saying, I'm writing a book about Ben Orr, and, you know, I just got through saying how private a guy he was. I had to convince a lot of people to be willing to talk to me.
Yeah.
It was a lot of painstaking work, I tell you, to undergo such a task. But, you know, in the end, I feel good about it. The interview process was long because a lot of these people wanted to see what was going to be said in the book. So I'd interview them. I'd create a passage, if you will, for the book that they're involved in. I'd let them read it. I'd let them help me edit it. They'd come back and go, I didn't say that, or I didn't mean it this way. And I'd go back and forth with these people doing interviews until it was exactly the way they wanted it, and then they'd sign off on it to be in the book. So it was a lot of hard work and a lot of convincing and gaining trust from people. And but, you know, in the end, it's great because, knock on wood, I didn't have anybody come back and say, you know, I didn't say that, or you didn't do this right or that right, because it's, a lot of these people knew exactly what was going to be in the book as far as what they said to me. So it eliminated a lot of problems in that regard. And I think everything worked out pretty well.
Yeah, it did. I'll tell you, having been in the clubs back in the day, occasionally I would, you know, bump up against certain people. And my friend's band opened for, I believe, the one with John. They played a place in Peabody. And I went up and I looked at him and I just said hi and I nodded and I didn't engage him in a conversation. There's a couple people like that in the scene you always kind of wish you had, and now they're no longer with us. A question I have for you. You know, him and Rick connected back in Ohio. It seems from the book that basically Rick would plow the road and he would invite Ben to come in behind him and fill everything in beautifully. Did you get that impression that, you know, once the doors opened, Rick opened the doors, Ben was right there?
Yeah, you know, in a lot of ways, that is how it went down. You know, Rick was always the leader. Even before they had a band, Rick was like, Rick kind of went about it in the opposite way of, I mean, most bands, you know, a whole bunch of friends or whoever, guys who all like the same kind of music, however bandmates hook up, you get together, you start a band, you start writing songs. Well, Rick did it the opposite. Rick would write a batch of songs and then try to find the musicians who could fill the bill.
Yeah.
He kind of flipped it and did it the other way around. So he was always writing these batches of songs, and he would bring in musicians, and then when he got tired of it or this isn't going anywhere, he'd, you know, get rid of all the musicians and write a whole bunch of new songs and bring in more people. But Ben was always the standby. He always stayed. He always kept Ben with him. I think, you know, partially because Ben was such a versatile player. I mean, Ben started out as a drummer when he was 12.
Yeah.
Started out as a drummer. When I mentioned the Grasshoppers, his band when he was 17, he was the singer and the rhythm guitar player. He ended up playing bass because when Captain Swing formed, he was just the front man for a bit. He didn't even play an instrument.
Yeah.
He was just singing. And then when they turned into the Cars, they needed a bass player. So that's how Ben became the bass player.
Yeah.
So the way you described it is Ben would come in and kind of fill in the cracks is really true.
Yeah.
Whatever the band needed at the time, that's what Ben would do.
He managed
to survive with Rick, you know, up until, of course, you know, the magic formula of the Cars was created, and then they were all set.
Yeah. It seemed at some point, you know, near the end of the book, when they were doing the, you know, they went through the thing with Mutt Lange, and it seemed to start the pressure in the band. And then when they went to do their last record, which Rick Ocasek, I think, was Door to Door.
Yeah.
It seems that the friction had risen, and you don't really get a feeling. You get a little inkling that between Rick and Ben, things were starting to fall apart a little bit, and maybe a couple of the other members, too, they weren't happy. Is it, you know, maybe because they were together for so many years, or the pressure of, you know, having to put out a product and you're famous and there's a lot of expectations and, or, you know,
you know,
maybe things take a left turn.
You know, I think there was a little bit of all the things that you just said. I don't think there was any one reason or any particular incident that happened. I think it was something that sort of happened over time. And I think that, you know, how I had mentioned that, you know, Rick was the leader of the band. So Rick was the songwriter. I mean, once, you know, they went into the studio, you know, the other guys in the band got to, you know, put their two cents in as they were, you know, putting melodies together and those types of things. But Rick wrote all the lyrics. So Rick obviously got all the publishing. And Rick made a lot more money than the rest of them.
Yeah.
So I think that was playing a part towards the end, too. Rick was getting tired of being on the road. You know, that whole write an album, record an album tour, you know, and then, you know, rinse and repeat over and over and over again. So I think he was getting to the point where he didn't want to be on the road anymore. So you look at the other guys in the band. Well, Rick's writing all the songs and has all the publishing rights, so he makes more money. How do the other guys make their money? They go on the road.
Yeah.
And they do shows. So now all of a sudden Rick was less and less wanting to do shows, and the guys in the band felt alienated, you know. Okay, so now not only are you not going to write another album, we can't tour anymore. So I think that created some animosity as well.
Yeah.
And there was some things between Rick and Ben, but I really do think that, like I said, it wasn't necessarily one particular incident or situation that was happening. I think it was a buildup of a lot of things going on all at once. And then it finally got to, and you know, and another thing, towards the end, right or wrong, Rick was a little bit more of a dictator. I mean, the last album they did, he produced it. You know, he pretty much had taken over most aspects of the music videos. So he was pretty much in control of the band at the end. And I think that, you know, played a part in what ended up happening to them. So it's a complicated thing.
Yeah.
As you can imagine.
Well, we're getting kind of close to the top of the hour. We'll do a wrap up. Is there anything else that people want you want people to know about yourself or about the book or about Ben to kind of tie this all up?
Well, you know, the book has been out. I mean, it was released in November of 2018. So it's been out for a few years now. And, you know, the Cars have a very loyal and strong following to this day. A lot of Facebook groups, social media stuff. I've connected with tons of fans. They're really nice and generous people. And, you know, it's if you're a Cars fan, I think you should get this book, because in all my interviews that I did, there's a lot of Cars information in there as well. And it's gotten some pretty good reviews, so I'm pretty proud of it overall. And just to let people know, you know, you can go to Amazon or whatever online and find it, but I also have a website, and okay. I also offer personalized copies. It's real easy, benorbook.com.
Okay, that's great. I was going to ask you about what your info was. What's for the future for you, Joe?
Well, I'm actually in the process of talking with my publisher. They were happy that with the numbers that my first book produced. So I'm currently looking at, it's going to be a music-related book, but I don't really have it pinpointed yet. I have a few ideas that we're sort of fleshing out with my rep at the publisher. And one idea is an actual Cars book this time around. It's one of the things that's being discussed.
Okay, that's so great.
Yeah, so I'm in the process of doing that. I have a book page on Facebook, too, so I always have updates there. So if anyone wants to Google, they can just Google the title of the book. You can find my Facebook page and follow me there. And I always put all kinds of information about what's happening next. So anybody can reach out and find me. It's pretty easy to get a hold of me.
Well, thank you again. The book is called Let's Go, Benjamin Orr and the Cars by Joe Milken. And that's on Bowman and Littlefield. And you could probably order online or get a hold of Joe directly. Joe, thank you very much for coming on the show. And we will definitely keep in touch and anything else going on in the future. And thanks for coming on Radio Bookmark and WMFO. Thank you again.
I really appreciate you having me and taking the time, Michael. And you were very informative.
Well, thank you.
It was great talking with you, and I really appreciate your time. You made me real jealous talking about all the awesome clubs you went to back in the day.
Yeah, it was fun. Well, hey, you always have my ear if you need some info.
I may take you up on that, sir.
There you go. Well, thanks again. Thanks, and we will talk to you soon, Joe. Take care, and you and your wife have good health.
Thank you. Thanks, man. I really appreciate it. We'll talk soon. Take care.
Okay, you're welcome. Okay, that's going to probably going to do a little music here to go out with the Cars on Radio Bookmark. Thank you for listening.
love the 80s, but tired of the usual hits. Satisfy your 80s fix with DJ Savoir Faire on Songs from the Squid Pod, Friday nights at 10 p.m.
This is a great social opportunity for us. Come on!
I think I've nearly found you.
Meet me in Downbeats, titillate your 80s chakra, and exhale through your inner garage. Songs from the Squid Pod with
my name is
Friday nights at 10 p.m.
It's a date. It's a scam. Whatever. All right.
Only on 91.5 FM, WMFO, Medford.
Fantastic to mundane. Brilliant to dumb.
91.5 WMFO, Medford.
I gotta go right now. Someone is videotaping me in my spaceship.
Suffer softly. Suffer sweet. These are the darkest hours we're ever gonna keep. I can't embrace this solitude. I can't erase distance from you. Stop for your touch. I don't know what to do. The madness all around, so absolute. Suffer softly. Suffer sweet. These are the darkest hours we're ever gonna keep. Suffer softly.